It's showtime.
People pay good money to see this movie. When they go out to a theater, they want cold sodas, hot popcorn, and no monsters in the projection booth.
Everyone pretend podcasting isn't boring.
Turn it off.
Ella, she'd done lots of bad things. A lot of people can't forgive her.
Hey, Els. So where'd you get to?
You didn't answer it in that part.
No.
Really?
No.
I have two daughters, but I don't live with them anymore.
We want to take the girls to the lakes for half term.
Right, but you said I could have them here for a couple of days.
Oh, here it comes.
No, it doesn't come. I don't see my children.
Well, that's not our fault.
I think you should go to meetings every day and put
Please
the work
stop.
In.
I'm not going to get my kids back if I sit around in cafes with alcoholics.
Hi.
I'm Neil. You look really sad. I want to help.
I'm going to beat you.
No, you're not.
Oh, yes, I will.
No, you're not.
You look like a goldfish doing out of your mouth.
What?
Do you remember what you did?
Yes.
You need to fight for them. Get out there and fight for your kids. Because one day, your life will be over and you can't go back and make it better.
It's all such a mess, isn't it?
It really will be all right.
Hey folks, welcome to a special episode of The Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. On this episode, I'm talking with Stephen Moyer. He is the director of the new film, A Bit of Light, which opens in the U.S. on April 5th, 2024. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this interview.
How did you decide to become an actor?
I had been singing in my church choir where I grew up from the age of 6 or 7. And I loved and still love choral music, but I'm not religious. But at the time, I think it was a way of parents getting rid of their kids. There was this thing called Sunday school. And so on a Sunday, they'd drop you off at the church hall with some volunteers. And then they'd get to go and do whatever parents were doing on a Sunday, insert idea here, as it were. And you'd do 9 o'clock until 1 o'clock or 9 o'clock until 12 o'clock doing like church stuff. And then at 12 o'clock, we'd walk over and we'd become the church choir. And that's a good 4 or 5 hours of parents getting their weekend to themselves. And I did that and I became the head chorister and I sang and I did love it. And my old headmaster of my school, in England, you go from elementary straight into secondary school. You probably know that. There's no middle school. So you age 11, you go to high school when you're 11 in England. And he had heard me sing in this cathedral somewhere. And he came up to me in that first or second term of my very first school, this little 10, 11-year-old boy. And he said, I heard you sing. We haven't done a play here for a couple of years. And I want to do Tom Sawyer and I want you to play Tom Sawyer. And thus, I started performing, loved it, then started looking for community theatre as well as like school theatre and joined many different groups. By the time I was 16, I'd started my theatre company and it just was like this inevitability that I was motoring toward this thing. Nobody did it in our family. Nobody in my school had ever become an actor. Nobody in my town had ever become an actor. Nobody, even in the little community theatres that I was in. There was one community theatre that had a couple of guys who still are pretty successful and people who I looked up to when I was 11 who were 18 and just going off to drama school. But it was a very unusual thing to do from where I was from. And it's interesting when you turn up at drama school because you've been playing the lead in school plays or community theatre plays and you're the big fish in that little tiny pond. And then you turn up at drama school and all of those kids that you go to college with have been doing exactly the same thing in the little towns that they were in. And you're all little tiny fish again. But yeah, so there was an inevitability about it, even though when I went to my careers advisor when I was 14 or 15, he did not have a clue how to do it. He did not know. There was nothing in our school files. We didn't even have a drama department. There was nothing in the school files to tell him how I would go about becoming an actor. I had to go to the library and read about drama schools and find out what they were. Back in the days of black and white, as my kids say, where there was no internet and you had to go and read a book about it and then write a letter. You wrote a letter to the drama school and then the drama school would send you back a letter saying, yes, you can apply. And then you'd write again and apply.
See, even I would know, like the book, you'd open it and say, go to RADA. At least I know that. At least I know one school over there.
I was in a place where I don't think I even knew what RADA was. I'm not even sure that I even knew what a drama school was at that point. Maybe I did. Maybe I'm doing myself a disservice. But when I found this like accredited book of drama schools, I discovered that there was Guildhall and Central and RADA and Bristol Old Vic and Lambda and a few others. And I was lucky enough to get a couple of places and ended up at Lambda, which is actually when I'd done the tour of all the places was the one I really wanted to get into. So it was great.
How soon after you graduated were you getting professional jobs?
I graduated in the July and in around the September, I auditioned for a few things, didn't get them. And then I got a job that Christmas, started rehearsing in November. My first professional engagement was a musical of Oliver, which is a big old staple in the UK, the Dickens Oliver Twist, but the musical of it. And I was playing Noah Claypole, who is this character in the Sowerberry's Funeral Parlor, and everybody else. I was the knife grinder. I was one of the guys in the... And it's quite interesting because I was in the main house at this, the National Theatre of Wales. I was in the main house and in the Black Box Theatre next door over that Christmas. There was a production of Hamlet happening where Toby Jones, Rhys Ifans, and Jack Davenport were all doing their first jobs out of drama school. And Toby was playing Osric, Rhys was playing Rosencrantz, and Jack, who was only 17, was playing somebody who brought in something on a piece of paper or something. Then I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company. I came out of that gig and went straight to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And in the April, finished that job around the end of January and started in April at the RSC.
You've done so many roles over the years. What have been some of your favorites to do?
Sounds so corny to say this, but I did a world tour of Romeo and Juliet when I was about 24. And that was really extraordinary. It's very strange when you leave drama school and all you want to do is get paid to do what you have trained to do. And you do it. And you're getting paid to do the thing that you've trained to do. You know, as an actor, that's the sort of pinnacle. I had no dreams of being to Hollywood blockbusters. I didn't think I was going to leave England. It was about working. That was an amazing gig. Funny enough, I did a job for Russell T. Davis where I played a PTSD First World War soldier coming back from the First World War called The Grand. Russell T. Davis wrote Queer as Folk, wrote It's a Sin, recreated Doctor Who. He's a genius. I love that character. I went to France and I walked the trenches of the First World War by myself for 3 weeks, which was a really amazing time. A friend of mine had a house in Normandy and let me use it as my base. And then I just went and set up and had a tent and walked the trenches and it was amazing. That was quite a soapy show. And I don't say that in a derogatory sense, but I did a lot of research in the way that one would. And I loved it. I'll skip over a few. I did a film where the film was an amazing experience. I loved the character, but the film was an amazing experience, which was Quills with Joaquin Phoenix and Kate Winslet and Michael Caine and Jeffrey Rush. And the experience of being with all of those people was very interesting. It's a really great part, written by Doug Wright and directed by Phil Kaufman. And Phil had done everything from the right stuff to the unbearable lightness of being. So it was a really interesting person to be around. I really loved him. And written by Doug Wright, who just wrote the play that Sean Hayes got the Tony for, and Doug's brilliant writer. So that was amazing. The next thing that really stands out would probably be, I did an NBC miniseries called Uprising for John Avnet about the Jewish uprising in Warsaw in 1942. And I played a character called Kazik, who was based on a real life Holocaust survivor, who was one of the people who smuggled a bunch of Jewish people through the sewers of Poland, of Warsaw, before the Nazis came in and welded all of the manhole covers shut. Kazik saved 39 people and became a sort of massive hero. And that film was based on his memoir, which is called Memoir of a Warsaw Ghetto Fighter. And I got to hang with him. So in Slovakia, they rebuilt the entire four blocks of the ghetto. And I was there for 4 months. And I was one of the only sort of non-Jewish actors on that. And John Avnet had met me and really liked me, and we'd gone really well. And he chose me because of Kazik's ability. His real name was Simko Rotim, but he was known as Kazik. And it was because of his ability to meld onto the Aryan side of the ghetto. He was able to go under the wall and pretend to be a non-Jewish character. He actually pilfered a dead Nazi soldier's uniform at one point, and then posed as a German soldier walking through. Imagine the balls. He was about 15 when he did this. And so getting to know him and being part of his life was really extraordinary. And we kept in contact all the way up until he died. So he was really influential. Yeah. And I'll throw one more in there because I'm thinking about it. I did a job with Peter Weber, who went on to direct after finishing this job. He did a thing called The Girl with the Pearl Earring, which is a really good gig with Scarlett Johansson. But the job that he did before that was a two-part series for Channel 4 called Men Only. And it was me and Martin Freeman pre-The Office and a really wonderful British actor called Mark Warren, who you'd know. And that was a very dark, interesting project. I loved that character. And you're doing the gigs and you're trying to make a living. And sometimes you're doing things that aren't as important as others, but and then sometimes something comes along where you're just like, I cannot believe that I'm getting paid to do this. This is a dream. And I still have that feeling. I haven't actually done anything other than act since I left drama school. And I feel like that's an amazing thing to be able to say. And that's not to say, by the way, that anybody who's going up and doing working as a hod carrier or a cement mixer or a bartender or a waiter is any less than me. I've just been lucky enough not to have to do it. And one of my kids is training to be an actor. And I said to her quite recently, I was just like, you're going to do a lot of other things. You're going to do many things. It's a really tough time to come into the industry right now. And that said, when I was at drama school, I was doing all of those things. I was landscape gardening. I was working in ticket offices. I was bartending. I was playing piano in a boat on the Thames. I'd flipping burgers. I was doing so many gigs, but I'm just lucky enough to be able to say that once it actually started paying, did a Doritos commercial in Hamburg in like 1992 or three. That was very helpful. Paid the rent.
You directed a few episodes of True Blood. How did you manage to make that leap from being a primary character on the show to directing a few episodes?
I had this meeting with Alan Ball at the end of season one. He'd asked me into his office to say, is there anything that you need to tell me? Is there anything that you feel like I'm not managing to do with your character? Is there anything that you think I'm missing? And we talked about possibilities of where the character arc could go, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, is there anything you'd like to ask of me? And I said, I started my own theater company back in, and I'd made a couple of short films, and I wondered, and he went, no. And I was like, he was like, I never let actors near my work. It's never going to happen. And I was like, oh, okay. And it's not like me and Alan didn't get on well. We did. I was extremely close to him and I loved him. But I also realized that this was like not a thing. Season two happens. Great time. Had an amazing time. He calls me back in for that meeting at the end of the year. We talk about possible ideas of where Bill could go, anything you'd like to ask of me. And I said, I know that I'm never going to be able to direct the show, but I said, would you consider letting me shadow somebody next year? And he looked at me and I think he was like, oh, you're clever. And he was like, I can't really stop him from shadowing somebody. And so sure enough, the following year, I shadowed a really wonderful director called Anthony Hemingway, who did a whole bunch of our episodes. And then the fourth year, they let me go and sit in the edit. I went and sat in sound. I sat in the mix. I sat in the edit suites. I sat in the offline. I sat in the online. I went to the ADR sessions. And then in season five, Alan was like, okay, here you go. Here's your episode. And yeah, I owe him a lot. I don't think I tell him that enough.
What was making your first feature like?
There's making television for HBO, and then there's making an indie. For example, in my first episode that I directed for True Blood, there was a scene where Sam Trammell's character is playing opposite himself. He becomes himself. It's actually his girlfriend is a body shifter, and she becomes Sam to try and save Sam's life. So Sam has this very earnest conversation with himself because his love, his girlfriend, has become him to try and pull focus away from Sam. And he has this scene where he's having this conversation with himself, and it happens all the way through the episode, but there's this particular scene where she's dying and she's laying in his arms as Sam, unable to get the energy to force her way back to being herself. And Sam is lying with him in his arms, and they have this very romantic conversation, but it's Sam and Sam. And so I'd done some research, and I knew I wanted to use a motion control head. Very expensive. Motion control head, for those who don't know, is literally a dolly slash head for operating the camera, lens, focus puller, all within one. And you have to train it. You have to have the operator and the focus puller and the dolly operator and everybody doing the move until you get it right. But the motion control head records what it did, and then it repeats it over and over again. And what that means is you can insert actors and take out actors and stuff, but it means that at all times the backdrop is always the same. So when you're rotoscoping and taking out the person, it's always the same place at any point in the timeline. It's an incredibly expensive but much cheaper way of creating two people in the same shot. We had things like that to play with because it was HBO. My first feature was under $1 million. And by the time season five had come around, it was $10 million an episode or something. My first feature was under $1 million, had Cynthia Nixon, Melissa Leo, Reese Ifans, Anna Paquin, Dennis O'Hare, and we were shooting on location. Road movie in Canada, 17 days. So it's a very different proposition. There's no time to rehearse because you're getting those, like we actually only had Cynthia for 15 days. Ed Asner's brother had died 2 days before, so we didn't get him until the morning of shoot. And he had an 11-page monologue, basically, which he didn't know. And so you're dealing with, and you've only got that restaurant slash cafe for that day. And there's no coming back, and then there's no overtime because we can't afford it. So it's really tough, but it's also really liberating because there is a magic that comes out of desperation, I find. I don't get panicked by it. My energy oscillates in a much more sort of positive way. It's, okay, I can't do these 17 shots that I was going to do. How can we do all of what I wanted to do and still make it artistic and creative, but do it in two shots? And I was lucky to have a wonderful DP on that job called Guy Godfrey. And we had decided early on we were going to do everything handheld because it's this road movie about this family looking to try and find evidence and the whys and wherefores of why one of their beloved family members has killed themselves. And it's actually really this coming together of this disparate family coming back together. It's what it's really about. And so we decided we wanted the camera to be like the sort of fifth member of the family, like even her, if you like. So there were times where we were thinking, like, if they were sitting around the table, where would she be sitting? And we'll be her observing, and which basically meant that it was always on his shoulder, which for anybody who doesn't realize that, it takes a lot of the difficulty out of setting up track and setting up dolly shots and setting up all those sort of things. And Guy's one of the great steady handheld VPs I've ever seen, and lights beautifully. He's up for another Canada, like their version of an Oscar / BAFTA for a TV series he just did. He was, I don't know whether you saw, there's a wonderful movie called Brother in the last couple of years. He was the DP of that. He's amazing. We're actually talking about working on something again, and having that sort of collaborative and brilliant group of people around you, as well as those actors that I named, a really fantastic first AD, makes those little indies go and makes them work. And it's fucking hard, but you do it. You just have to do it. It was also minus 18 degrees centigrade, it was something like minus 30 Fahrenheit. And we were doing a road movie with an 87-year-old. It was really amazing. You just learn to work under the parameters by which you're working, and that you haven't got a techno crane. When I directed A Bit of Light, by some weird happenstance, we ended up with 17 days again. Producers had asked me, how many days do you need? And I said, 25, but I can do it in 20. And then by the time we started raising the funds, and it's Anna Paquin and it's Ray Winston, and Ray's a big name, and no disrespect to Ray, but not cheap. I don't mean somebody of Ray's importance, you have to pay. And again, we were under $1 million. And so it's like, they came back to me and they said, after we pay everybody and after all the crew get paid and after everything else, you've got 17 days. And we're working with a kid actor who can only do 9 hours a day. And so you just make it work. Are there things that one would change in the films? Yeah. Yeah, of course. Would I have had more rehearsal if I could? Yeah. Would specific scenes have had more time on them? Of course. There's one scene where we had 45 minutes and we shot the entire scene. And I've got one take on the wide, I've got one take on Luca, and I've got one take on Anna, because we had 45 minutes to shoot it. And the lights go off at 7 o'clock. So there's no overtime, because there's no money to pay anybody overtime. When you're putting it together, do you want to be able to go, I don't want to go to a different show out there? Yeah, but you make it work. And there is a magic in that. I just came from, in the last year, directing Sexy Beast for Paramount Plus. I did the last two episodes. And being on something again where you've got a budget, had this amazing grip team, Northwest Grips, they're called. Shout out to Damo, if he's listening. And John, who was organizing my techno crane, there's a heist sequence where these guys are tunneling and they have to break through a wall. And where the set was built, the end that we went into was, just for argument's sake, 8 foot. And then as they break in through this bit, there's a drop, and the boys have to take all the equipment down into this underground tunnel. And they put all the equipment across, and then there's another wall that they have to drill through. This is in episode 8 of Sexy Beast. Highly recommend watching. I'm very proud of the sequence. And they then have to drill through that wall. Now, just so happened that that wall was like 6 feet as opposed to 8 feet. So when we were in the pre-production meeting, just about to go and shoot all of this stuff, John, who was one of the grips, but who was in charge of the cranes, was like, he's like, Steve, I've been to look at the studio, and I'm looking at the angle where the camera's going to come in for the first shot. And then the other shot is 6 foot, and the one at the other end is 8 foot. And he said, so that's like a whole day to move. We can't use that same crane because the crane base is, I'll get it to 6 foot. It's going to be, so I've had an idea. What about if I set up another base from another crane, which will just be, that won't be a techno crane, but that'll be something that I can put on the dolly. And having people with that sense, I was so overwhelmed and emotional that day, because we were trying to work out how we were going to shoot it. And he'd gone, and he'd, in his own time, after shooting, he'd gone and he'd measured, and he was like, how am I going to do this? And he's like, I can set up a piece of track there. The other end's going to be on a techno crane anyway. So we can do both things in the same day. Because what I wanted to do, of course, was travel down the tunnel behind the boys in the tunnel, a real tunnel. And then what I wanted to do the other end was, as they're coming towards us, was receive them. So as he's coming down towards us in the tunnel and he comes to the wall, you want to see him coming towards you, but you have to be in the tunnel to be able to do that. And so, and if they're two separate heights, that's a whole day's worth of changing there. So what they did for me, those boys, was just extraordinary. But having those resources, you're just like, God, having resources and having other people thinking for you and doing things for you is so nice. And on an indie, you're throwing those decisions around in the moment, trying to make it happen. So it can be a different result, but it's not less rewarding. It's just a different experience.
When did you actually shoot A Bit of Light?
A Bit of Light was September, October 2021, end of September through October 2021. And I went on to another gig, and my lovely editor, Todd Sandler, put together an assembly. And then in the beginning of March 22, I started editing. I finished around, I want to say July. And then we went to festivals at the end of 22 and beginning of 23. A Bit of Light is a very emotional, tiny little movie about somebody going through a really difficult, difficult place in their life. And we had just come to the end of the pandemic, the coming out of the pandemic and out of lockdown. A lot of the things that were being bought were speedboat chase movies, and people didn't really want to go and sit and watch a heavy drama. It is a heavy drama, but it also has a lot of hope in it and a lot of laughs. And it's an interesting thing, because when you watch the movie with an audience, and once you've heard one person laugh in the audience, you go, I'm allowed to laugh. And then it really builds. And then it has a completely different sort of reaction as people start to laugh at certain moments, as opposed to watching it by yourself on a laptop. You might not have that same experience. It's really interesting what an audience can do to change the mood. And maybe it takes one or two or three people to realize, oh, that's ironic. That's sarcastic. They didn't mean that. So it plays really nicely in an audience setting. But funnily enough, because the first movie, The Parting Glass, is about the aftermath of a suicide, it was similar. Sometimes you'd be in a house where you wouldn't hear a pin drop. But sometimes I remember an audience in Santa Fe, at the Santa Fe Film Festival, where it was raucous hilarity, because they really got the humor of it. And it's just so funny. It's just, it depends where people are at that day and how people think they're supposed to react in a situation. It's a really interesting dynamic, theater audiences.
So you've got limited budget, 17 days. You're shooting this during the pandemic. What other challenges could they throw at you with this?
The weather. We got really lucky the first week because we were shooting all of the playground stuff. So Anna's character has a history of sort of destructive behavior. Her and her partner have split, and they've agreed that she's going to have some time away from the kids while she gets her act together. She's moved back in with her dad, and she's broken. She feels like she has let those kids down, and she feels like that she doesn't deserve them, and she feels like they're better off without her. And she's so self-sabotaging and broken that she goes to the local park that she used to go to take them to when they were little. And she watches other children play to punish herself for how she thinks she's let them down. Whilst she's there, a 13-year-old boy, she's invisible to everybody, but there's a 13-year-old boy who watches her, who sees her. And it's the first time that she's been seen in her life since this sort of incident has happened to her. She's very resistant to being helped. She doesn't want to be helped. She doesn't think she deserves to be helped. But this little 13-year-old boy decides that he's going to put her back together. It was the middle of October in England, and it was bright sunshine in the park. It was like it had been pouring with rain all week leading up to us shooting in the park. And then we had these 3 days of just majestic sunshine, late autumn sun that we call an Indian summer in the UK. And long shadows and beautiful light and magic hours, just incredible. So we started there, and that was just amazing. And And then it's when it started pouring, we were doing the interiors in the house. So things like that went really well. We were really lucky. But at the end of the gig, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but there is a very large square footage of water that Anna might end up in. And it's the end of October and it's freezing cold in England. And it was freezing cold. And so there's things like that. The enemy in indie movie is time is the enemy, because you're just never in a situation where you can go, do you know what, guys, this doesn't look right. Let's come back tomorrow and pick this up. Or if you've booked a cafe to have a cafe sequence, for example, there's a cafe scene with Pippa Bennett-Warner and Yusuf Kakua and Anna. We only had that cafe for 4 hours because they wanted to reopen again in the afternoon. And we'd got a whole nother scene to do, like in that village, like a whole nother part of the film to do in that village in the second half of the day anyway. So you're under this massive pressure to shoot a 4.5-page scene that's very important in that morning before lunch. And then everybody runs and gets lunch. And then it turns into dark. And then the next scene's in the dark. And you've got to shoot the boy who's only got certain hours and he has to be gone by a certain time. And he's the lead in the scene. And so they're the kind of challenges that you're facing. You're facing weather and difficulty. And funnily enough, in that scene that I'm referring to, Yusuf Kakua and Luca Hogan, who plays the kid, Neil, have this really interesting scene outside a pub. And we had to be taillights at 10 p.m. And we were working in this pub. But taillights means that you have to be gone. The local council has agreed for you to be there, but you have to be gone by 10 o'clock, like taillights. And if you actually watch the film, there's this moment where Yusuf is walking away at the end of the film after Luca's left him. And you hear in the background, you hear a church bell ringing. And the church bell is ringing. And that's real. And it's 10 o'clock. And as Yusuf has that final moment, and he looks up at the church and he looks back to where Luca was. And literally, and I went, and cut. And everyone was like, and we had struck. The dolly was gone. The cameras were gone. We were out of there by 7 minutes past 10. It was unbelievable. So they're the kinds of challenges. And it's, would Yusuf have liked another take? Sure he would. And would we have liked to, there was like this, oh, I know what I was going to say. There were these really drunk northern boys who were there in Suffolk working. They were building a house and they'd gone out on the piss that night. And this little village that we were in had two pubs, and we were in one of the pubs, and the other pub at the other end of the village was where they all were. And they came out to come down to our pub at about 9:30 and shouting and screaming and singing songs in this little village. And Yusuf is in the middle of a speech with Luca. And again, I've got that footage. He had two takes, and in the edit, you can hear, we had to take it out, but you can hear the boys shouting at him from behind the camera, going, what are you doing, mate? Mate, who are you talking to? And Yusuf never, ever drops. He never goes out of it. He stays completely in character the whole time with Luca. And it came to the end of that take. And I said, we're going to have to go again on that, guys. And I went up to the boys and I said, hey, guys, look, we're filming something. It's not our problem. I know. But we're coming up to, it's nearly 10 o'clock and we have to be out of here at 10. So what? We want to go to the pub, you know? And I just ran back and I went, Yusuf, let's just go again. And he was like, mate, just call action. And we did. And they started shouting again. And then, of course, so when you get into the edit, you then have to remove all of those noises. Yusuf has to do it in ADR. You have to create the sound of the town as it was. And we had a lot of Foley to do for that. But at that final moment when he was walking away, Todd was like, I kind of like the church bell. Let's keep it in. I was like, yeah, church bell's great. And Yusuf looks at it. So make use of what is good and turf out what is bad and just keep moving.
Now, does Anna give you a discounted rate?
Here's the honest truth. One of us needs to get paid because we can't do it as a hobby. I can't afford for it to be a hobby. So let's just say that and I got paid, and I might not have.
Good. So what's next for you?
I am going to the UK very soon, a couple of weeks, to do a, it hasn't been announced yet, but I'm going to go and do a period drama, 6 episodes. It's really good. I really like it. In the middle of that, there's a movie that I really like, again, which hasn't been announced, which I really like. What I can say, I think, is it's about Russian hacking in the 2016 American election is the subject. So what we're trying to do is carve out my days on that movie for me to fly back from England to do those days. That takes me through to like the end of the summer and for both of those projects. And then I have a little film that I'm trying to get made. I've got a really great producer. It's a film that I've been part of for about 3 or 4 years. I love it. Another female protagonist, 50-year-old this time. And that is called Finding Grace. That's about a woman who does the Chemin de Compostela, which is the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, which is a very famous pilgrimage and that goes from sort of southern France through to northern Spain. It's about 1,000 miles and it ends up in Santiago where the bones of the Apostle St. James are supposed to be buried. And a lot of people do that pilgrimage. And it's a really fantastic story about a family losing their way and coming back together again. I love it. We're trying to sandwich that in there. And then at the end of the year, I've got a little detective series that I'm part of, which looks like it's going to happen in Ireland. And then I've got other things planned as well for the New Year. So I'm just grafting, man. Just trying to keep all the balls in the air.
With how busy you are, I really appreciate you taking all this time to talk to me because it seems like you are just out there doing it.
You've caught me at a time where I am adulting and just being a dad.
Mr. Moyer, thank you so much. This was so great talking with you.
And you, man. Appreciate it.
Now go enjoy the rest of your lunch if you can.
I'm going to have the rest of my salmon salad.
All right. Thank you again.
Comes to a view, which one will you choose? Beginning to see.